You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 13th of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we head to Norway to discuss the devastating report into police incompetence that failed to stop Anders Behring Breivik. We'll also be hearing from our Washington correspondent, Sasha Eisenberg, about Paul Ryan, the man Mitt Romney has chosen as his running mate.
Join me in welcoming the next president of the United States, Paul Ryan.
Yeah, he got that one wrong. As the Olympics draws to a close, we'll ask what the event has done for London. And as the latest edition of Monocle hits newsstands this week, we'll be giving you a taster of what to expect. Finally, we'll also hear from photographer and filmmaker Susan Shulman.
I embarked on this journey, which was horrendous. Slogging through jungle, which was absolutely impenetrably dense, in mud up to my knees, and I'm trying to film at the same time, which didn't really work out very well.
That was Susan Shulman. All that plus some Olympic-ish music, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. As ever, a packed show, but first, here's James Luckhurst with the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. An opposition leader in Syria has said the rebels fighting to oust President Bashar al-Assad near the protection of no-fly zones and safe havens patrolled by foreign forces near the borders with Jordan and Turkey. Abdel Basset Sida, head of the Syrian National Council, said the United States had realized that the absence of a no-fly zone to counter Assad's air superiority hindered rebel movements. In other developments, the Iranian Foreign Minister Ali Akbar Salehi has called on Muslim countries to work together to bring the Syrian situation to an end.
The Syrian crisis is a fact. There is a crisis there. Every country, specifically Muslim countries who are members of the OIC, should join hands to resolve this issue in such a way that will help towards the peace and security and the stability of the region, and that will stop the violence, will stop what's the destruction which we are witnessing now in Syria, unfortunately.
An official report published today says that Norway's police could have prevented the bombing of central Oslo and caught mass killer Anders Behring Breivik more quickly. The independent inquiry says his subsequent shooting spree on Utøya Island could have been halted earlier. Breivik has admitted killing 77 people and wounding more than 240 others when he bombed central Oslo and then opened fire at a youth camp on Utøya. The police have been criticised for taking too long to reach the island. A verdict in the trial is due on the 24th of August. Officials in Uganda say the pilot and four crew of an attack helicopter on its way to Somalia that made an emergency landing in Kenya has been rescued, but two other gunships and 10 crew members are still missing in the same area. Ugandan troops form the backbone of the African Union force fighting Islamist militants in Somalia. Felix Kulayigye, a spokesman for the Uganda People's Defence Forces, said one pilot managed to send out a distress signal after making an emergency landing.
Between 1900 to 2000 hours, one pilot sent a distressed call that he had made an emergency landing in the mountains and calling for rescue. The other two could not be traced. What is confirmed now is that the one which made the emergency landing in the mountains have been traced. The pilot and the crew have been rescued. They are all safe and they have been evacuated to Nanyuki Air Force Base. We are yet to confirm the whereabouts of the other two with the 10 people on board.
A Vatican magistrate has ordered Pope Benedict's former butler Paolo Gabriele to stand trial on charges of aggravated theft for leaking documents alleging corruption in the Vatican. In a 35-page dossier on the case, which has rocked the Holy See since Gabriele was arrested last May, the Vatican also charged a computer expert who worked in the Vatican bureaucracy with involvement in the case. Olympic athletes have said that Rio de Janeiro will have a tough act to follow when it hosts the 2016 Games. As Heathrow Airport braced for one of its busiest ever days, competitors passing through the specially constructed departure terminal were full of praise for the way the London Games had been organised. The British government minister responsible for transport, Justin Greening, said the government had confounded the sceptics by proving it could move huge crowds without a major hitch.
I think there was a lot of scepticism, but we did run the transport system really well. Londoners did work with us to retime their journeys, and that helped mean that we could fit everybody on the tube. We had record numbers. So it's been a brilliant performance, and of course we've got to do it all over again in 2.5 weeks when the second biggest show on earth arrives in town, which is the Paralympics.
Those are the top stories here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. I must say, I do like the... There's billboards all over London at the moment advertising the Paralympics, and it simply says, thank you for the warm-up. You're listening to Midori House. It is 18.05 here in London.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And Monocle 24 highlights, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, yeah, you're welcome.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. The trial of Anders Behring Breivik, the far-right extremist who killed 77 people in Norway last summer, may have provided Norwegians with a certain amount of closure, but answers to how he was able to carry out his attacks have been few and far between, until now. An independent panel investigating how Norwegian authorities handled the attacks has today released a report, which has found that police could have done more to stop Breivik. The car bomb which he set off in Oslo was, says the report, a recurring scenario in threat assessments for many years. A faster police response could have also stopped Breivik's shooting spree on the island of Utøya. To discuss the report further, I'm joined from Oslo by Kirsti Løken-Stavrum, a journalist at Aftenposten. Welcome to Midori House, Kirsti. Was it expected that the police and the authorities would be criticised quite as strongly as they have been?
You know, it has been, the report has been very much looked forward upon because we have been waiting for this sort of conclusions to what did go wrong. We know that lots of things went wrong, but we needed sort of a formal conclusion on that. We didn't know and we didn't suspect that it was the police that were going to take the most of the criticism, but we knew or had... There were some leaks that we knew that there would be harsh critics on how it was handled on the 22nd of July.
And what's likely to happen next? I mean, is it likely that certain people within the police force and elsewhere within government may take responsibility and offer resignations?
Yeah, I think it will be extremely strange if no one is going to resign after this report. This morning, the leader of the Parliamentarians 22nd of July Commission, he said that I expect the report to change Norway, nothing less. And and considering the really harsh criticism that has been put into this report now, someone has to resign. You know, Already the Minister of Justice has resigned. So obviously the new Minister of Justice cannot resign. And the Police Surveillance Institute, the domestic surveillance, has really not been that criticized. But the leader of PST, as that institution is called, has already resigned for something else. So I think we expect someone in the police, someone rather centrally placed in the police will need to resign.
And I wonder how this has changed people's attitudes towards the police. Because, I mean, some of these mistakes are, I mean, when you hear them read out, are quite astonishing, you know, from basic flaws in communication systems to you know, an overloaded boat carrying a police anti-terror unit breaking down. The only police helicopter was unused because the crew was on vacation. Were many Norwegians shocked at the level of, we can probably say, incompetence that the police displayed?
I mean, if when you list them out as you did now, you obviously feel sort of embarrassed by it, considering we are a very modern society. And I do think that people in general are very surprised by the way police handled it. And I do think that the report now sort of draws a picture of Norway as a very theoretical society. But they have revealed that the police in practice are not that good. So what I think we see is that we have a police force that is very academic, very report oriented, but not very good at handling dangerous situations. Like one of the parents of one of the boys that was killed at Utøya said in one of the papers today, the police didn't dare to do their job.
And do you think that has shocked people that happened? I mean, do you get a sense that there is a willingness amongst the police to reform after this report?
I sincerely hope that they would like to reform, but we know very little of the culture within the police, and other than I do think it's rather strong culture and boundaries within the police force. So I don't know if they can handle all these critiques at once. Some already says that this report will be placed on the desk for years to come and be a very, very problematic reminder of how we didn't handle the most crucial attack on Norway after the Second World War.
Looking more generally, I mean, in the immediate aftermath of the attack, Norway's Prime Minister Jens Stoltenberg said, you know, the answer to this attack is more openness, it's more democracy. Do you think that's actually happened over the past year or so?
No, maybe not really. What we have handled is that we have managed to keep all the important debates within sort of a temper that is that has been it feels rather good that we can discuss things without being very angry or without being how to put it, very, very critical towards each other. So the debates have been very constructive, I think, but how to measure more democracy and how to measure more openness. You know, today, Aftenposten's headline is that this government has been more reluctant to openness than the other, than the former governments have. So, no, I don't think we're that much more open, no. And when this report now was released, simultaneously, 12 meters of documents were transported directly into the archives and will be put there for the next 60 years. So there are still lots of things that we don't know about the research behind the report.
Kirsti Løken Stavrum at Aftenposten in Oslo, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back in a moment and we'll be talking about the Olympics.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture. From the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
Weekends on Monocle 24 are for relaxing, taking stock of the week's events, and keeping an eye on the week ahead. The Review is our hour-long Saturday show, looking back at the books, TV shows, films, and events that have made our week, as well as a regular magazine review. Monocle Weekly, our original audio offering, is where it all started. Tyler Brulé, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck discuss the week ahead with guests, analysis, and a good helping of music. Perfect Sunday listening. And if you need a short, concise summary of the week's highlights, look no further than the curator, in association with Rolex, a one-hour roundup of all the juiciest bits of the past week on Monocle 24. So listen to The Review, Monocle Weekly, and The Curator for the full Monocle 24 weekend experience, either live on Monocle 24, on our timeshift player at monocle.com, or on iTunes.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's over. Last night, the curtain came down on the London Olympics with a raucous, entertaining, though at times slightly embarrassing, closing ceremony. Over the last 17 days, the Games have shown the world a whole new side to London and Britain. In fact, it's not just the world that's been surprised. We've been pleasantly taken aback too. To discuss what the Games have done for the city and the country, I'm joined now by three Monocle editors, Andrew Tuck, Robert Bound and Sophie Grove. Hello.
Hello there.
Hello.
Hi, Steve.
Hi. Hi. Firstly, let's get the bad stuff out of the way.
Are you referring to the closing ceremony?
I am referring to the closing ceremony. Rob, I know you didn't watch it because you were at the other closing ceremony, which Blur were performing at Hyde Park, which I gather was actually rather good.
That was good.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's not talk about that. Andrew, what do you make of it?
I thought it was disappointing, but I thought it was disappointing because it was kind of what you'd expect. And I think what had so shaken people by that kind of opening ceremony, when it began, people thought, oh my God, is this the worst thing I've ever seen or the best thing I've ever seen? And then they realised it was, you know, crazy and eccentric and it was very British and it came off. It was like, it was something against the odds. They hadn't tried to do what was safe. And this was just a lot of people who, you know, are kind of very middle-of-the-road pop stars doing their thing and doing the thing that they do in a kind of bland way. It just felt, after all of the kind of enterprise and energy that had gone into the days before. And I think the funny thing, as someone else said, is suddenly by the end of the Olympics, you realise that pop stars aren't really stars. You know, the stars have been these athletes. And in a way, it just felt wrong to them try and be usurped by some kind of B-list band.
To have three songs from Jessie J.
For example.
Three songs too many. Sophie, I mean, Andrew's picked up on those quite interesting, that we live in an age of celebrity and often, you know, people get famous for doing very little. And yet over the past 17 days, we've seen people becoming famous for working extremely hard.
It is strange because when you see the sort of boy band style sort of manufactured pop, and some of those artists were amazing, but in the way it was presented, it was kind of formulaic, and it is right. You know, you had all the athletes sort of crammed into the crevices in between this Union Jack, and you felt sort of actually they needed a bit more of a go. And it just felt like they were rolling out everything they could, you know, every, like a kind of compilation, rather than anything that had a narrative or anything that was risky or sort of clever.
Let's talk about the good stuff. Rob, what were your highlights over the past fortnight, and what do you think they tell us?
I like the modern pentathlon, where people have to ride a horse, jump off it and run around. They have to shoot straight, and so they have to sort of run sort of 10K or something, and then shoot a gun, and then like run and jump on a horse. And they get on horses that they don't know, because they're not professional riders. So they kind of get given a sort of random horse. They might as well be given a cow. I mean, and the horses are sometimes going the wrong way.
It's all oddly skills you might need if you were a highway robber.
Yes, exactly. In the 18th century.
Swimming.
Yeah, exactly.
Horse riding.
Dick Turpin got gold, I hear. it's a sort of bizarre sport. And this is supposedly a sport that's founded on what you need to be a soldier circa 100 years ago.
Quite quaint that they still do it, I guess.
Yeah, I rather like that. And there's fencing in it and all these other kind of...
I love how it's called the modern pentathlon as well.
The modern pentathlon, yeah, exactly. It needs one extra for it in order to live up to the closing ceremony, which is then to survive the opening stages of the X Factor. And then it would be a proper modern pentathlon.
All the thons were amazing, weren't they?
Yeah.
Like, when you have a sort of series of things you have to do...
I didn't see that many thongs.
I was going to do that, and then I thought, I'll save it for Andrew.
But it means feet.
You're the only one who heard the silent G.
There's a lot of one-trick ponies out there, just, you know, running up and down. I mean, they're amazing too. But it is wonderful when you can see people doing all of those different events in a succession. I mean, they must be exhausted, for one, but it's so dexterous, and it really is impressive.
And also, to be vaguely political for a moment, on that Saturday night when Britain won three gold medals, you had Mo Farah, a Muslim refugee from Somalia. You had Jessica Ennis, mum from England, dad from Jamaica. And you had Greg Rutherford, Ginger. So you had all bases covered. I mean, it was a real sort of representation of what
it was. And I think that was the best thing about the Olympics was firstly sort of being able to be very proud of the Union flag. And because of this, because for once, this is what it symbolised. And it was all these people waving it. And I thought it was you could be very proud to be British because it kind of redefined what the point of a country is, which isn't about your parentage or the colour of your skin or your religion or lack of it or whatever it is, but literally a place, a landmass or a state that allows you to be brilliant. And that seemed to be what Britishness was, especially on that Saturday night. It was a really wonderful thing.
And I thought also just an image of a country oddly at ease with itself. And we had the images from the riots a year ago. But here was a very different country, a country that felt very comfortable with the people that were, you know, representing it, very comfortable with supporting anybody who was, you know, part of Team GB. I felt there was something about the Games that whoever you were, when I went to that stadium, when you were with 80,000 people, it was so different. And they're all watching to a pinprick silence the same moments or roaring at the same thing. You realise that within this country, there is a kind of, there is still a communal feeling. There's still something collective. And that was, I thought, an amazing kind of image of Britain.
It was amazing, actually, that kind of visceral collective experience that people had when they were in stadiums. And they had, in the velodrome, they had that kissing monitor. So it was so romantic being in the stadium. Because there's a sense of just that, I don't know, it was a spectacle. And it felt like the Colosseum. And when this kind of roar of people, apparently it was reaching sort of like the sort of absolute decibels of a Boeing taking
that's
off.
That's right,
or
yeah, that was
like
in
that.
Their boxing arena, wasn't it? That they said it was like a Boeing 747 taking off.
And you just can't, I mean, that's the enthusiasm of the British public, really. And yeah, they're known for being sort of slightly sort of, I know, self-deprecating. And there was a question about whether their enthusiasm would really kind of show, and actually it was amazing. People couldn't have been more genuinely excited by it in a way that didn't feel manufactured at all.
And it's also, I guess, worth pointing out that this was a Games that it took Britain quite a long time to embrace. I think partly also because the day after, the very day after we were actually awarded them, the bombs went off on the underground and on the bus. So there was never a real sense of actual celebration about having the Olympic Games and discussion about what it really meant, because we quickly moved on to something far more serious. And then obviously there's all the discussions about the cost and things overrunning and so on. And even up until the week before, lots of people were very sceptical, Rob, weren't they?
There was this great thing that happened with G4S, the security company. They didn't have enough guards. They hadn't trained enough people. And then we had soldiers. We had, you know, manning the things, which is another great boon for British PR, actually, in people who you would feel safe being guarded by rather than some people in a purple tracksuit who don't know what they're doing, who've been trained by a private enterprise. And then sort of lots of sort of genuinely friendly bobbies in what it would normally be the one time of the year where a bobby's smiling on the front page of a newspaper, kissing someone at Notting Hill Carnival or dancing with a girl in kind of like a carnival costume.
And
that was for 2 weeks, and that was kind of the unexpected kind of good PR as well.
I wonder if there was just a kind of feeling as well that British people thought that we'd mess it up again, because every time you do these grand projets, they all go horribly wrong. You know, the O2, Terminal 5, they're always late, they don't quite work. And I think people were just uneasy that, oh my God, this is all going to go wrong again. So I think that there's also something to be learned about how you run big public project like this, because it did work.
And it's also worth pointing out, okay, all four of us around this table are British, and this could all seem like a little bit of a loving, but I mean, one of the things that struck me when we were doing the Midori Houses on the road, and we were talking to Swiss journalists or Brazilian journalists or Danish journalists, is the number of those, Andrew, that were saying, actually, you've done really well here. London seems like a great city. I didn't realise it was going to be this good.
I think they were all, you know, impressed by how the infrastructure held up, how well the actual park worked for the sports. Let's just admit there is one risk here, and which is that, you know, that the government did pile a lot of money into this project, and they spent a ton of money to make sure everything went right. And the risk is that when the Games pull out, we're left with the old infrastructure problems, and actually the railway begins to creak again, and the airports don't quite work because they pull out the resources. There's still a question about Britain as its infrastructure. Let's be clear, it's not a giant Switzerland, but it did for these weeks get it right.
Sophie, do you think there's likely to be a long-term attitude change amongst British people that actually, you know, we've always had that impression beforehand that we can't really do anything. We used to have an empire, we used to be great, but now we're just a little bit rubbish. And that sort of changed over these past couple of weeks. Can that be a long-term change?
I mean, I hope so. It does feel like, you know, we don't want to have this idea that we're shambolic and endearingly shambolic all the time, because actually, as Andrew said, it did feel a bit like Switzerland. I mean, partly because a lot of people left London and everything seemed to be running smoothly. It does show you that if you put money and you really focus on your infrastructure, it works. But I think it's been really interesting for the identity. And we spoke to Ken Livingstone, who was the mayor who got the bid in the first place, and he was saying this shows that actually you don't have to be a royalist or from the right wing to be patriotic in British society. And actually that could be a sort of identity shift that might have a real legacy.
Rob, final thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. I'd agree. I think it's given us a kind of new set of heroes who kind of haven't kind of, it's not their 15 minutes of fame, it's the 15 years of hard work that's got them to this, which is it's a nice sort of change of power, I guess, into the hands of these people. As you started off the discussion saying, worked damn hard to get there, and they kind of deserve to be on the top tier of the podium.
Quite right. Rob, Andrew, Sophie, thank you very much indeed. We're going to end this little Olympic segment by playing one of the songs that was at last night's closing ceremony. This is one of the good ones. This is one of the good ones. Sadly, she didn't appear herself, but this played while they showed lots of shots of Olympians, so it's good, and we love it. It's Kate Bush, Running Up the Hill. That's a brilliant Kate Bush, who of course wasn't actually at the closing ceremony because she's a recluse and hasn't performed live for 33 years. But there we are. It's 18:30 here in London. In the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll be getting the lowdown on Paul Ryan, Mitt Romney's new running mate, and we'll also dip into the new issue of Monocle. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
An opposition leader in Syria has said the rebels fighting to oust President Bashar al-Assad need the protection of no-fly zones and safe havens patrolled by foreign forces near the borders with Jordan and Turkey. Abd al-Basid Sida, head of the Syrian National Council, said the United States had realised that the absence of a no-fly zone to counter Assad's air superiority hindered rebel movements. An official report published today says that Norway's police could have prevented the bombing of central Oslo and caught mass killer Anders Behring Breivik more quickly. The independent inquiry says his subsequent shooting spree on Utøya Island could have been halted earlier. Officials in Uganda say the pilot and four crew of an attack helicopter on its way to Somalia that made an emergency landing in Kenya has been rescued, but two other gunships and 10 crew members are still missing in the same area. Ugandan troops form the backbone of the African Union force fighting Islamist militants in Somalia. A Vatican magistrate has ordered Pope Benedict's former butler, Paolo Gabriele, to stand trial on charges of aggravated theft for leaking documents alleging corruption in the Vatican. In a 35-page dossier on the case, which has rocked the Holy See since Gabriele was arrested last May, the Vatican also charged a computer expert who worked in the Vatican bureaucracy with involvement in the case. And Olympic athletes have said that Rio de Janeiro will have a tough act to follow when it hosts the 2016 Games. As Heathrow Airport braced for one of its busiest ever days, competitors passing through the specially constructed departure terminal were full of praise for the way London Games had been organised. And those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
So, in the end, Mitt Romney proved he was a gambling man after all. Faced with negative polls that refused to budge, Romney forswore the safe option and chose a running mate who is certainly a big risk, but, Romney will hope, may also offer a big reward. Paul Ryan is a congressman from Wisconsin, but he is no minor figure in the Republican Party. The author of two controversial alternative budgets, he's the darling of the Tea Party right and viewed by centrist pundits, most of whom are usually wrong, it's worth pointing out, as a sensible if bold conservative. To find out a bit more about Ryan, I'm joined now on the line from Washington, D.C. by a correspondent in the U.S. capital, Sasha Eisenberg. Sasha, welcome to Midori House. Let's start by looking at what this pick about Paul Ryan actually says about Mitt Romney himself.
As you said, it's by far the sort of most audacious thing Romney has done in this campaign, and I think it's probably the most interesting political thing he's done in his whole career. Two things. One is he is willing to take a gamble and do something risky. But I think that the other thing to me is it revealed a certain self-awareness about his own weaknesses or shortcomings that Romney has typically been sort of loath to expose. I mean, Romney's general posture towards the world is, I was a success at business, I was a CEO, I started companies, I was a governor, I know how to run things, I'm Superman. And this is where, this is sort of a point of contrast that he used against Obama earlier in the campaign. Obama's never worked in the private sector, he's never created a job, he's not up to the job of being president. Mitt Romney, in not only picking Paul Ryan, but talking about the need for a partner in Washington, somebody who will help him govern, who understands how Congress works, is saying, in effect, my resume is incomplete if I were to become president. I don't know how to enact the things I want to enact, and I need this guy who's a specialist in Washington. Mitt Romney tried to distance himself from Washington, has distanced himself from Congress. He's now picked a career politician who spent his whole life trying to master the legislative process and saying that he, Mitt Romney, needs Paul Ryan to govern. That's giving something, showing a sort of amount of a knowledge of his shortcomings and a certain weakness that's very un-Romney-like, I think.
Well, that's one of the things that confuses me about this pick. I mean, there's a number of things that confuse me about it, but that's the first. Mitt Romney has made a big thing about, the economy is my thing, I know how to run the economy. And yet, essentially, by choosing Paul Ryan, a man who's known as having such strong views on the economy, which aren't necessarily Romney's views, he is, in a sense, contracted out his economic policy to this guy. And this is not necessarily middle-of-the-road stuff, is it?
I know. I mean, I think the first rule of the Romney-Ryan ticket is that it immediately sort of disavows the whole set of strategy and tactics and messaging that accompanied the Romney campaign, certainly, since April or May when he won the nomination. That critique of Obama as has never worked in the private sector, is a career politician, that's obviously not something we're going to hear a lot more from Mitt Romney on, because he just picked somebody who's spent even more of his career in politics and has worked even less in the private sector.
Yes,
than
he started
Obama.
As an intern in Congress and was elected in his 20s.
He was a staffer. I mean, he's more than almost anybody we've seen in sort of national political life. He's worked up the ladder and only on Capitol Hill too. So I think that's a big thing. But also, I feel like, the focus, we sort of talk generically about the economy or economic policy, but Romney's campaign was very focused on job creation and his critique of Obama, which was this, he's not done enough to create jobs, was not part of a broader let's reinvent, reconceive America's fiscal and financial and monetary situation. It was, I know how to create jobs because I've created jobs in the private sector. Paul Ryan is, an expert in the budget, was chairman of the budget committee, but he's talking about long-term fiscal changes, mostly to these very expensive government entitlement programs that would change the budgetary condition of the United States. He's not talking about short-term job creation. So by picking somebody who changes the subject, it's a dramatic shift. We'll still be talking about stuff that has dollar signs attached to it, and it'll still sound like we're talking about economic issues, but we're going to be talking now about what type of public support pensioners get and what the, amount of interest we're paying on the debt is a decade from now, and when the deficit may disappear and the budget will be balanced, not is the unemployment rate going to be down in 9 months if we change the tax code. And that's where Mitt Romney was telling us he wanted to take this election earlier in the year. He's now taking it somewhere entirely different.
I mean, these strike me as sort of quite massive changes and the sort of things that perhaps won't necessarily work in Romney's favor. I mean, it's obviously too early to tell, but I mean, do you think this, does this strike you as a smart decision?
I've been skeptical of it. I've talked, you know, like everybody, I sort of spent the weekend talking to Republicans about it, some of whom were excited and positive about it. Democrats who, I cannot find a Democrat who doesn't feel better about this campaign now than they did 3 days ago. But nearly everybody agrees that this was done from a position of weakness on Romney's part, that this sort of dramatic change in how he is going to run against Barack Obama is not the type of thing you do if you think that you are in a safe or strong position, or that the sort of structure of the race, fundamentals of the race, are tilting in your favor. He's now sort of thrown out his playbook, is going to start, spend the next 3 months of the campaign sort of with an entirely new way of running. The one thing that even Republicans who are skeptical of that are cheered by is it does show a certain willingness to acknowledge he was wrong, that I think some people wondered whether Romney had. But it tends to be the campaigns that realize in August that they're bound to lose and do something dramatic. Mm-hmm. Don't necessarily end up winning afterwards.
Now, obviously, the pick last time round for Republicans of Sarah Palin was controversial and arguably damaged the, well, I think not arguably, I mean clearly damaged the John McCain campaign. The only thing that's arguable is whether he could have won with anyone else anyway. But, I mean, traditionally, VPs don't necessarily have a huge impact on the race, do you? I mean, if you think back to 1988 when the Republicans had Dan Quayle and the Democrats had Lloyd Bentsen, and Bentsen, you know, pulled Quayle apart in the vice presidential debates, and Quayle looked like a bit of an idiot, which he kind of was. But that didn't stop George H.W. Bush winning, did it?
No, I mean, so there are two different ways of thinking about it. We always sort of look, when people have tried to measure the effect of a vice presidential candidate, on sort of discrete changes. Did they move a state and its electoral votes, or did they move basically a demographic group? Or when we went out and polled, did people say that they were more likely to vote for a ticket because of the VP or not? By that measure, the only time in American history that I think there's been a clear influence is Lyndon Johnson helped John Kennedy win Texas in 1960. Mm. And
there are issues over how he helped him win there as well.
Yes, certainly, but he probably he helped legitimately, and he probably helped illegitimately too in Texas. The thing that Ryan has the potential to do, and you know, after 48 hours, I don't think we want to rush to the idea that the whole race will change for the next 3 months in this way. But there hasn't been a vice presidential candidate who sort of changes the agenda in the way that Romney seems to be willing to have his agenda be changed by his pick. You know, he's and part of that is that this is really unusual in that the running mate has not just a far more sort of detailed resume than the presidential pick. I mean, you know, Joe Biden had a much bigger body of work than Barack Obama did 4 years ago. But Ryan has a far more rich, specific, detailed worldview than Romney does. And Romney had sort of very emphatically rejected any efforts to be specific or detailed or sort of lay out holistically a worldview, especially on controversial issues like the, you know, size and role of government. He'd been very vague throughout this campaign. So now he picked somebody who has it, and now Romney seems to be choosing to enter into a world where he's going to sort of reshape his campaign to find some sort of consilience with the way Ryan sees the world and government. And that's something that we could talk about for the next 3 months. And so it's possible that this campaign could change because of Paul Ryan, not because he moves Wisconsin or because Catholics move to him by 10 points or old people move away from him by 10 points, but because it takes that job creation discussion or the conversation about Iran or about, you know, Mitt Romney's taxes and pushes it aside, and we start talking about a whole other set of issues that weren't really part of the architecture of this race. That's possible.
Sasha in Washington, thank you very much. And Sasha actually raised one other issue there, which is worth picking up, that Paul Ryan is a Catholic. The only candidate on any ticket, any of the four candidates, who's actually a Protestant, is Barack Hussein Obama. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with some more music.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey.
And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
You're listening to Monocle 24. Join us at 2200 hours London time and end the day with the Monocle Daily, live every weekday.
You're back with Midori House. Sophie's going to be back in the studio in a moment to talk us through the new issue of Monocle, which hits newsstands on Thursday. Sooner, of course, if you're a subscriber. If you're a subscriber, you've got it in your hands already. We're going to play one more song. This is, again, from last night's closing ceremony. One of the best bits. No Jesse J. This is Waterloo Sunset by the Kinks. That was Waterloo Sunset by the Kinks. You're back with Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's 18:46. The new issue of Monocle is going to hit the newsstands on Thursday. As I said before, if you're a subscriber, you've got it already, you're ahead of the game. It's a good one. It's our September issue, and it's our first ever defence-themed issue. It's got a very handsome man on the front in army uniform. And here to tell us all about not just him, but other things inside. Sophie's back. Hello.
Hello. Hello. Couldn't stay away.
You couldn't. You couldn't indeed. So yeah, it's our first ever defence issue. Do you like it?
It's a very handsome issue, isn't it?
It is.
And I'm not just talking about the man on the front.
No.
He is a real soldier, by the way.
Yes, he is. It's not a model. It's a real soldier. He's called Christopher, I can't remember his surname now, Rolson, Christopher Rolson. He's 19 years old. He is a recruit at the Norwegian Military Officer Training School.
What a jaw line.
Yes.
Quite something.
I went up to Norway for a couple of days to Ifjimorn, which is about an hour's drive north of Kristiansand. So quite sort of in the southern part of Norway, to spend a couple of days with these guys. And it was just incredible. My favourite photo in the whole... there's so many lovely photos in this issue, but my favourite is the spread on pages 92 and 93 of about 20 soldiers with backpacks on marching through a pine forest.
It's interesting, though, that story about the Norwegian officer sort of training course got us thinking about a lot of the issue, this idea of, you know, what makes a modern army, what makes an armed forces really excel, what makes it fit for purpose in the 21st century. And I mean, we co-authored the introduction and really ended up having sort of extended conversations about this, because when you take a global look at defence, you start realising, you know, where the strengths are. And when you speak to defence analyst after defence analyst, and they say the same things, and then you look at the where the investment is going, and we did come to the conclusion that so much investment was going into hardware and not into these people.
Exactly.
And I think that, you know, our cover man, boy, soldier, really does sort of, he's kind of indicative of some of the values that you really want to see in your modern fighting force. You know, there's that intelligence that's there, and there's a sort of sense of, you know, crafting the people and not just the kind of military guns and tanks that you need to sort of really succeed on a global scale.
We looked a little bit at hardware as well, although again, sort of old style hardware with our aircraft carriers. We went on board the USS George Washington when it was docked in Hong Kong. Our Asia Defence correspondent Trevor Moss did that. And again, great pictures as well. I mean, it looks just stunning. But you get a real sense of, I mean, just the scale of this thing. I mean, there's one photo here on page 51. I mean, you can count, I'd say about 20, I think I remember counted 23 planes on the apron there, on the deck, with the Hong Kong skyline just behind. And you just realise that all this investment is going into drones and cyber warfare and so on. The US still feels it needs something like an aircraft carrier. Well, 11 of them all over the world.
I mean, it's staggering, really, when you start looking at taking yet another global perspective. And the US really does trump everybody, you know, by so many fold, it isn't even worth thinking about. But it's very interesting that the Section A, we looked at that geopolitical race to build and place aircraft carriers, which are momentous pieces of hardware and kit. And also, they just need so many experts to operate them. They need so much infrastructure that surrounds them. They're massively symbolic in the sort of global race to sort of have this incredible stature.
They are indeed. We're going to be looking through this issue every day this week on Midori House. But for now, Sophie, thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House. Susan Shulman is an award-winning photojournalist. Originally from New York, she's spent the past 12 years capturing many of the world's forgotten tragedies, from the horrors of childbirth in Sierra Leone and child soldiers in Sudan, to the wretched plight of gold miners in the Amazon basin. More recently, she's travelled to Congo with the Rwandan Defence Force as part of a groundbreaking attempt to destroy Rwandan Hutu militia, the Interahamwe, also known as the FDLR. Monocle's Georgina Godwin caught up with her to hear about her experiences and the challenges of filming in the country.
The first time I went to the Congo was in 2006, and it was on a commission for the UNHCR. And I was really intrigued to go there. I was fascinated by a situation in which I knew that 5 million people had actually died over the previous 10 years of war in that country, yet it so little was known about it.
So for a girl from New York to go off to the Congo, it's a big thing. And you were on a particular story. Tell me about that story.
Well, to tell you about this, we have to go back a few years, because in 2009, there was this big historic agreement between Rwanda and Congo that would remove other rebels from the picture and incorporate the other errant players within the Congolese military, and together they would rout out the FDLR, who, as I was saying, are the former genocidaires from Rwanda. And so I wanted to see what this looked like, because the east of Congo is notoriously undeveloped. I think it was a characteristic that Leopold even deliberately maintained.
The King of Belgium.
Yeah. The King of Belgium when it was his colony. So, in fact, what we ever see in Congo is the tiny, tiny, tiny little minority of people who actually make it to the few roads in the area. So, in all my infinite wisdom and persistence, I managed eventually, it took some doing, to persuade the Rwandan authorities to drop me into the bush.
Wow.
With them, because I wanted to see firsthand what it actually meant on the ground to rout out the FDLR and what the challenges were and the territory were. Well, I have to say one of the finest moments of my life was when this helicopter is searching for its smoke signal on the top of a mountain, and then we start finally, after have they finally spotted it, to land on this bush landing pad that had obviously been hacked out just by the soldiers who were there on the top of a mountain. And we're landing on top of these reeds. It was like the finest moment. I just thought I'd died and gone to heaven. It was such fun.
You went back to these villages which had formerly been completely deserted and terrorised by the FDLR. Now they have come up with their own fighting forces, Mai Mai fighting forces, fighting back. They've got weapons and things have really changed there.
Yeah, things have really, really changed. In maybe some ambivalent ways as well. I mean, before, when the FDLR were the rulers, it was horrible, absolutely horrible for them. You know, there was all the rape and the torture and the intimidation and blah, blah, blah. Oh, sorry, I don't mean to be, you know, minimizing that, but they were imprisoned. But now, the FDLR is not there, but they're only pushed back into the bush. And now you walk along those same paths on the patrol, and over a distance of 16 kilometers, both to the north and to the south, there's absolutely no one in any of the villages. And that's for the villages which are still standing. Because I literally walked by, past a village I had been to several times in the past and not even recognized it because it had been completely obliterated, burned to the ground, invisible now. And so now those people who are left in the community, huge amounts of other of displacement, further displacement has occurred since November 2011 when this local forest took on the FDLR. And they're in camps and in homes, in situations similar to those of the families I'm following, 90 miles away. But the others are living in terrible shelters, just huddled against the bush. And then others have returned to sleeping in the bush, taking refuge there. Now, I knew that this had been going on over the years, from time to time when insecurity demanded it. But I really, really wanted to see it, understand what that meant. Invariably, children come out of there and they're malnourished. So I wanted to see. Well, I embarked on this journey, which was horrendous. I mean, again, 25 minutes turned into an hour and a half, slogging through jungle, which was absolutely impenetrably dense, in mud up to my knees. And I'm trying to film at the same time, which didn't really work out very well. And an hour and a half later, I arrive at this clearing, and it's like, it just breaks your heart. These little children who are just looking at me like I'm some alien from Mars, slightly frightened before they kind of get the courage to approach. And there's nothing in their makeshift shelters. They're actually sleeping on dirt that their parents try and find some banana leaves to cover. And it's actually, it's the most beautiful place in the universe. But it's also rainy, even though it's dry season. It rains every day. And it's chilly at night. And it's just outrageous. I mean, but again, there's this indomitable Congolese spirit which takes matters that are important to them into their own hands. So there's a real kind of positive drive that they have that's inspiring. Mm. But it's a terrible situation. And now my ambition is to bring all the filming that I've done beginning in February 2009 through the subsequent years up to now, and tell the story in full so that it's a privileged and intimate look at the impact of this ongoing long-term conflict, which actually is conducted out of visibility.
That was the photographer and filmmaker Susan Shulman speaking with Monocle's Georgina Godwin, and that was from this weekend's The Weekend Edition. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. Thanks to Dawn Trump, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ben Jay. Up next after the news is this week's episode of The Culture Show with Robert Bound, and today they're looking at the Edinburgh Festival, which is still on. Do go up there if you can. An arts extravaganza and possibly the funniest place on earth.
The first question everyone says to you in any dressing room or any car journey to a gig all year round is, are you going to Edinburgh this year? And the amount of people that say, oh yes, you know, I'm going up and doing an hour show, and you think, you haven't even got a serviceable 20.
That was stand-up comedian James Mullinger in 3 hours time. That's 2200 hours here in London. Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller will be back for the Monocle Daily. Robert Bound will be sitting in this chair for Midori House tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Du lytter til Monocle 24.
Você está escutando Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Akute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives: that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.